Right, hi everybody, thank you for coming. I'm very glad to have you all here to talk about transcendental realism. Hopefully it's going to be very exciting. There's not much else to say, so I'll pass on to our first speaker, Tom O'Shea from Essex, who's going to tell us about the very idea of correlationism, really.
Thanks. Firstly, I want to thank Pete for inviting me to give the talk. I'm pretty far from being an expert on recent continental metaphysics, and usually I spend a lot of my time thinking about autonomy and practical reason, especially in the context of German ideas. But hopefully I'll be able to turn my dilettante status to our advantage here a little bit by situating some of these issues in that context. As well as giving a kind of thematic overview of some of the issues which will crop up again and in more detail in a later talk. So hopefully what my talk will be able to do is a kind of gentle introduction to some of the more tightly focused material we'll get from others later. As the title of your handouts will have alerted you, I'm going to be discussing the notion of correlationism. As I expect most of you will know, this idea features in Quentin Mellisou's recent groundbreaking book, After Finitude. In a nutshell, the correlationist thinks that, quote, we only ever have access to the correlation between thinking and being, and never to either term considered apart from the other. Mellisou has two moves in mind here. So the first, which he calls the correlationist circle, is the claim that we can only ever have access to reality as it is for us, and never as it is in itself. And the second move, which he calls the correlationist two-step, is the claim that the subject and the object cannot be radically divorced from one another, that they are not two entities that merely happen to come into relation, but that, at least in some fashion, they form a primal unity, such that we cannot make sense of subjects who are not presented with a world of objects, and that our notion of objects always already presupposes a subjective standpoint from which they're grasped and situated. Mellisou thinks that whilst correlationism presents a profound challenge to realism, there is a transcendental argument, or at least an argument with a transcendental flavour, against this correlationism, which can vindicate the claims of empirical science to have access to reality, and, as he puts it, to know the absolute, no less. And that's the absolute not simply as it is for us, but as it is in itself. So the goal then is to show that we can cognise a reality which is coldly indifferent to any human interest or form of knowing. Mellisou gives a good summary of the challenge that correlationism presents to such a project in this passage, which again is on your handouts here. He says, correlationism is the modern way of rejecting all possible knowledge of an absolute. It is the claim that we are locked up in our representations, conscious, linguistic, historical ones, without any sure means of access to an eternal reality independent of our specific point of view. Before I turn to Mellisou's presentation of the issues in more detail, I think it's worth reflecting on why such neo-realist arguments seem to have struck such a chord recently. And again, as those of you here will know better than most, there have been some very exciting moves towards realism amongst those working in the broadly continental tradition. And this against a backdrop of what is a pretty massive sense of disillusionment with three of the dominant movements in post-war Franco-German philosophy. So firstly, the phenomenological tradition, still haunted by Heidegger's brooding presence. Secondly, the kind of historical institutional analysis pioneered by Foucault and his followers. And thirdly, deconstructionist philosophy in the Derridean vein. I think it's difficult to ignore the sense of exhaustion, almost lack of oxygen, which has gripped these three movements, all of which seem to be in various stages of terminal decline. Perhaps less so in the case of phenomenology, but still, it doesn't seem to be on the up. And with this decline, I think we get a lot of the traditional vices of movements in decline. So an ever increasing scholasticism, a preoccupation with themselves and their own canon, rather than developing new positive projects, which push at the frontiers of the discipline. And crudely, it's possible to say that people's distrust of these major movements has coalesced around another kind of insularity which they exhibit, though. And that is one broad theme which draws together the phenomenologists, deconstructionists, and Foucauldians is, in one sense or another, a focus upon signification in its various forms. So whether that takes a distinctive phenomenological mode in talking about these nomadic relations, or whether it's linguistic or cultural, there is they come together around a particular concept of signification. But increasingly, I think philosophers are keen to talk about unalloyed reality rather than its modes of presentation to us. But that, at least it seems, that is what gets sidelined or prohibited by these traditional groupings of modern continental philosophy, or at least so the neo-realist suspicion runs. And I think to a certain extent we can explain the popularity of figures like Deleuze and more recently Zizek and Badu as down to the feeling that they represent something of a rupture with these once dominant movements, and are somehow better equipped to help us understand both social and non-social reality. And that's through their break with both any kind of strict phenomenological project and a kind of postmodernist fixation upon some crisis of signification or the prison house of language or what have you. But it might be thought that not even they managed to effect a radical enough break with a kind of subject-centred mode of philosophy. So we can think of Zizek's preoccupation with culture analysis, his focus on this idea of the revolutionary act as central to his thought, and even within Badu's more austere conceptual framework, you might think his idea of the event and also truth procedures is still, in a way, wedded to an unhealthy subjective orientation. Of course, that might be a bit controversial, but certainly people have argued as much that there's a residual subjectivism still, even in this break from traditional continental philosophy. And I think in this sort of climate, the rallying cries of an unmitigated realism are apt to find a welcome audience. And I think that's exactly what has begun of late. A loose grouping of so-called speculative realists has emerged, and while sometimes they diverge wildly over matters like the proper role of metaphysics, how we understand the relation of philosophy to science, especially the neurosciences, they're nevertheless committed to reviving a realist orientation allied to some sort of metaphysical speculation about reality once more, which we haven't quite seen, at least not in a confident, brash form for quite a while. So these philosophers include Melosu, Graham Harman, Ray Brazier, and a growing band of others. And while they are perhaps rightly rather uneasy about being lumped together into a single movement, one thing these speculative realist philosophers do all seem to be agreed upon is that Melosu at least gives us an accurate diagnosis of some of the problems in contemporary philosophy, on which it's seen as beset by some kind of correlationist sickness. And that's so, I think, even if they don't agree with his solution to the problem, which I don't think many people do. So defeating the correlationist is meant to clear the way for a resurgent speculative metaphysics, although, again, this can take wildly different forms in the work of different speculative realists. Okay, so much for the background, then. Now, I became interested in Melos's notion of correlationism, because it seemed to me to capture something significant about the orientation of much 20th century philosophy. So in the continental tradition, we do find a preoccupation with access and the relation between mind and world, at least to a certain extent. This is no less true of much analytic philosophy too, which at least for a long time was obsessed with language and understanding meaning and reference and so on, after the so-called linguistic turn. And the notion of correlationism can help us to highlight this problematic of access. I think it invites us to question whether charting our epistemic horizons should be the primary task of philosophy. But at the same time as seeing something valuable in Melos's framing the issues, I think there's nevertheless something deeply misleading about them too. And it's not so much that he's fighting a straw man, because I think that there are some correlationists out there, even if they are, in some sense, unwitting ones. And I'll shortly discuss one prominent historical example, though I think on balance there's probably a lot less correlationists out there than Melos and others tend to think there are. So instead, then, I think that correlationism as a form of argumentation, we should see it as a tempting trap for those of us who do recognise the finitude of our cognitive capacities, but who nevertheless want to maintain some form of realism about the epistemic and metaphysical status of the objects we confront with these limited capacities. I think correlationism, and particularly here this idea of the correlationist circle, which I mentioned, should have a place in our conceptual toolkits, but we have to put it to work in a different way than Melos's does. Furthermore, I think it's a big mistake to take a rejection of correlationism, at least in the form that Melos presents it, to license any of the heterogeneous sorts of metaphysical inquiry that speculative realists have got up to. So here, opposition to speculative metaphysics has rarely been premised on the sort of correlationist arguments that Melos considers. And knocking those arguments down ought not to convince us that there's somehow some sort of free run for speculative metaphysics once again. So with these preliminaries out of the way, I'll now go on to talk in a bit more detail about Melos's presentation of correlationism. I've already given us a sketchy outline. So, namely, that correlationists claim that we only ever have access to the correlation between thinking and being, never to either of them on their own. They're always presented together as part of a package. And Melos outlines the correlationist circle, which is set up here in the following passage, which is also in your handouts. So he says, "Thought cannot get outside itself in order to compare the world as it is in itself to the world as it is for us, and thereby distinguish what is a function of our relation to the world from what belongs to the world alone. Such an enterprise is effectively self-contradictory, for at the moment when we think of a property as belonging to the world in itself, it is precisely the latter that we are thinking, and consequently this property is revealed to be essentially tied to our thinking about the world." Now, I think there's an ambiguity here in the way Melos sets things up here. So he starts with an epistemic claim. We cannot distinguish what is a function of our relation to the world from what belongs to the world alone. But then he ends up by talking about properties which are somehow essentially tied to our thinking about the world. And this could easily encourage a more metaphysical interpretation, such that correlationism would be a claim about the constitutive role of thinking in constructing reality itself. But the ambiguity is quickly resolved, though, when Merleau-Sue distinguishes correlationism proper from speculative idealism. So the ordinary correlationist simply takes it that because we cannot get outside of our representations or our thought or what have you, the only sort of reality we know is one that appears to us in thought, such that we can know nothing about reality as it would be outside this framework of thought. But the speculative idealist goes beyond this. They claim that there is no such thing as a reality beyond our forms of representation, that the idea of such a reality, radically divorced or alien to the structure of our cognitive capacities, is a mere figment. And so they make a metaphysical claim about reality rather than an epistemic claim about the extent to which we can know it and how it's presented to us. So the correlationist has two enemies. On the one hand, there is the realist, and what Merleau-Sue sometimes, at least in his own distinctive form of realism, calls the speculative materialist. This realist claims that we can know reality as it is independently of any relation it might have to the forms of our thinking. That is, the realist thinks we can have access to reality as it is in itself. Or, in other words, it's possible to think about a reality which is indifferent to the fact that we, or anyone else, might be thinking about it. And that it's possible to think about this reality in its indifference, so to speak. So, unlike the correlationist, then, the realist denies that there must be a correlation between thought and being. But secondly, this is the second opponent of the correlationist, there's the speculative idealist, who goes further in the opposite direction, claims that the correlation is no mere epistemic limit. Instead, they claim to know what stands outside of it, precisely nothing at all. So as Merleau-Sue puts it, the speculative idealist has hypostatized the correlation between being and thought. They've made it into an absolute, the very correlation itself. At this stage, we've been presented with three rival positions. So there's realism, correlationism, and speculative idealism. So too, we've come across a brief argument for correlationism, this so-called argument from the circle. And that says that because to think about real objects always requires us to adopt some perspective as a finite thinking being, then we can never know what reality is like outside of this relation to the perspective of a thinker. If this argument from the circle is correct, then we can never have access to reality as it is in itself. And this has implications for the account of truth which correlationism is forced to give. And this is where Merleau-Sue begins the process of unravelling correlationism as a whole. Here Merleau-Sue raises what he calls the problem of the archae fossil. To set this up, let's call ancestral statements those that refer to events prior to the existence of life on Earth. For example, the Earth is approximately 4.5 billion years old, or the Sun did not coalesce in the first billion years of the universe's existence. So they're ancestral statements. Merleau-Sue invites us to consider the conditions under which those statements are meaningful, such that they can state the truths of empirical science. So it's important to be precise about just what strategy is being pursued here. So Merleau-Sue's not trying to identify the truth conditions of these statements, and nor is he committed to any particular ancestral statement being true, and nor does he, so it doesn't rely upon any in particular scientific claims about what happened in the early universe and so on. Instead, he's trying to identify a set of semantic conditions. So he's asking, how must we understand the meaning of these statements for it to be so much as possible that they be true? So in analytic jargon here, he's looking for the conditions for a kind of cognitivism about ancestral statements, such that these statements can be truth apt. Correlationism is then supposed to be unable to secure these conditions. It is unable to understand these ancestral statements literally But you must add what, and I think this is a lovely phrase here from LSE, he calls the codicil of modernity. So you must add the codicil of modernity if you're a correlationist. So the correlationist can claim that these ancestral statements are true, and perhaps in some sense true, just in the way in which the scientist understands them. But then they must add that in a deeper sense, we need to understand them as merely relative to our own forms of representation. So on this deeper and supposedly more subtle interpretation, we need to reintroduce the correlation between being and thought, such that it is only for us that the Earth is approximately 4.5 billion years old, say. As Melissou puts it, for the correlationist, ancestrality cannot be a reality prior to the subject. It can only be a reality that is said and thought by the subject as prior to the subject. And to give one of Melissou's examples here, the correlationist is obligated to reformulate ancestral statements in the following kind of weaker fashion. So they might say, the present community of scientists has objective reasons to consider that the accretion of the Earth preceded the emergence of hominids by X number of years. And whilst that may well be the case, if we have to understand all ancestral statements in this kind of revised form, it facially corrodes the sense of these propositions. Since these are propositions about the great outdoors and not the relations between our thought processes or what reasons we have and so on. And oddly enough here, Melissou does not conceive this line of reasoning as a refutation or a reductio of correlationism. Instead, he thinks that the archaeofossil considerations simply demonstrate that there's a kind of aporia here. So it seems that ancestral statements cannot have the meaning that correlationism must ascribe to them, but at the same time, there appears to be no way out of this correlationist circle which has been set up. So Melissou goes on to try and refute correlationism in a different way through an attempt to show that if correlationists are to distinguish themselves from their speculative idealist rivals, they must defend the contingency of the correlation. But if they do that, then they must be able to think of a situation without the correlation, and this leaves them open to attack from the realists. So I won't discuss this argument here, but I think it's going to come up again in Pete's talk later. In particular, I don't think it's very successful. But I think what we should note here about this strategy is that what's important about it is that Melissou tries to vindicate his own version of speculative materialism, on which the only necessity is that everything is contingent. Through a kind of internal critique of correlationism, and this is a part of the reason he's keen to insist that correlationism does present us with a profound problem which needs to be tackled rather than avoided. Nor is he alone in thinking this. So Ray Brazier, for example, has claimed that, quote, Melissou is right to insist that it is necessary to pass through correlationism in order to overcome it. And for my own part, I think that correlationism does not present realists with a profound challenge at all. Instead, the sort of correlationism that Melissou battles with can be summarily dismissed if it is presented as an argument against realism or our knowledge of the absolute. But for that reason, I think it's not available to be the basis of some sort of speculative materialism along Melissou's lines. And nor do I believe that clearing correlationism out of the way licenses us to engage in speculative metaphysics with abandon, or that we no longer need to be concerned with the finitude of our cognitive capacities. So in order to reframe the notion of correlationism, I want to draw upon a particular historical example of it from the early reception of Kant's philosophy. Now, according to most speculative materialists and realists, whilst Kant is, of course, no Berkeleyan idealist, he is the paradigm example of a correlationist. So I could go on about great length, but I don't think that's the case. But I'm not primarily interested in any exegetical point here. But instead, I want to highlight the temptation to force philosophical claims with a broadly Kantian shape into a correlationist mould. So I think this is especially clear in the work of Kant's contemporary and most influential popularizer, Karl Reinhold. It was Reinhold's letters on the Kantian philosophy that initially brought Kant's first critique to the attention of a philosophical public at large. And in his own work, Reinhold was troubled by what he saw as the lack of genuine systematicity in Kant's theoretical project. Perhaps not an objection which would first come to mind today when thinking about Kant. So as Reinhold saw it, Kant introduces a number of notions, so concept, intuition, reason, understanding, space, time, and so on. But he treats these concepts simply as given. But Reinhold, by contrast, thinks that the critical philosophy can only avoid any residual dogmatism if it can be given a single comprehensive foundation. And this, Reinhold tries to provide with his so-called principle of consciousness, which supports one fundamental faculty of representation, or Vorstellungsvermögen. Now, how does all this relate to correlationism? Well, Reinhold, in attempting to formulate Kant's position, makes a fateful error. So he claims, what is represented as object can come to consciousness and become represented only as modified through the form of representation and not in a form independent of representation as it is in itself. And then later, crucially, he continues, the concept of a representation in general contradicts the representation of an object in its distinctive form, independent of the form of representation, or the so-called thing in itself. That is, no thing in itself is representable. This is, of course, in a brilliantly succinct form, the correlationist argument from the circle, which we saw earlier. So Reinhold has argued that the very concept of representation precludes us from access to objects as they are independently of the form of representation. But there's a pair of problems here. Well, firstly, this argument doesn't appear in Kant. And two, and I think very much relatedly, it's a terrible argument. So let's consider the latter claim first. So in both Reinhold and Melosu's presentation of the argument, we face the same problem. The reason that the argument seems so impenetrable is that it tacitly defines things in themselves as unrepresentable, and so it doesn't at all prove that they are so. So Reinhold is concerned with knowledge and Melosu with truth aptness, where representability of the relevant objects is a necessary condition for each. In both versions of the argument, we are denied the necessary cognitive access to objects simply by stipulation. We are required to represent an object, namely some thing in itself. What's the very definition of a thing in itself precludes it from being represented by us, because then it would pass over into the status of something for us, or in other words, one of our representations. So this sort of argument cannot impose some substantive condition upon our ability to know reality, or to make ancestral statements, or anything else for that matter. Any epistemic limit it tries to introduce will be completely empty and trivial. And I think instead of this being some formidable argument from the circle, it's really a much more humble creature. It's a plain old circular argument. So why, if this is such a transparently poor argument, does it nevertheless hold some sort of appeal? And I think it's because it at least appears on the surface to be able to condense a much more powerful form of analysis concerning the finitude of our cognitive powers. So if we look to Kant, then superficially it can seem like something similar is going on as in Reinhold or Melosu's correlationist. So he too claims that we cannot have knowledge of the thing in itself and that our empirical cognition is directed only towards what he calls appearances. But these claims in Kant's work are the result of a rich analysis of cognition. And here, Karl Amerix is right to insist that there's no plausible short argument to idealism, as he calls it. There's certainly not one to be found in Kant. And here, from the bare fact that it is our cognition belonging to finite human agents, it does not follow that you cannot deliver the thing in itself. Instead of a short argument to idealism, Kant provides us with determinate limits on knowledge, which result from identifying a number of sensible and intellectual conditions in a number of concrete analyses of the use of reason, of the forms of space and time, and so on. Obviously, some of these are more successful than others. My point's not to defend any of Kant's specific epistemic claims here, even though I think say some of the things he says about the role of concepts and knowledge are, brilliantly accurate. Some of the things he says about space and time are, terrible arguments. But my point is that we can't dismiss all this analysis in a single flourish. And so, the reason why Reinhold was destined to be disappointed when he wanted to reduce the critical philosophy to a single principle, it's just that its arguments are too heterogeneous, too diffuse, even if they do subsequently feed into some sort of architectonic. And so, in supposing that there is a unitary source for constraints on knowledge, that Kant does... constraints on knowledge that Kant does introduce, Reinhold has to resort to this rather desperate correlationist argument from the circle. And in a similar way, Melosseux tries to identify a general strategy to convict all those who are suspicious of speculative metaphysics. But the arguments against speculative metaphysics in a realist mode, they don't share a general form, not even a loose one. And in particular here, it's important not to confuse claims and arguments about the conditions of empirical knowledge with those about the possibility of speculative metaphysical knowledge. And so if we look to look again to Kant here, and especially the first critique, Kant's opposition to rationalist metaphysics is not based upon some correlationist-style argument that would forbid us knowledge of the thing in itself. Instead, the opposition to rationalist metaphysics stems from the arguments of the transcendental dialectic, in which Kant identifies a series of antinomies, paralogisms, and other fallacies, which result from the various ways in which metaphysical inquiry can go beyond the limits of nature, and therefore outrun the resources of experience to settle metaphysical disputes. So, as I try to show, realists don't really have to be worried about the threat from the correlationists. So, nothing in the correlationist argument from the circle could introduce a robust epistemic or semantic limit on our access to the world. Perversely, it might create problems for those like Melosseux who have to rely on some internal critique of correlationism to support their own arguments, but that's a slightly different matter. So, I suppose I'm rapidly running out of time, so I'll make a final point here. So I think that although correlationism does not have the resources to threaten realism, this does not mean that we have, in Melosseux's phrase, reached a point after finitude. All it tells us is that this very general strategy fails, and from there we still have to address the more modest conditions upon and limits to our knowledge that stem from our finitude. So, here we can distinguish between conditions upon empirical knowledge and conditions upon metaphysical knowledge. Now, I think we can retain realism about our empirical knowledge in the sense in which we can know objects as they really are, irrespective of the peculiarities of our modes of access to reality. But that doesn't mean that there aren't still important constraints upon this empirical knowledge that we philosophers must acknowledge. And so, to give an example, John McDowell defends what he calls a minimal empiricism, which outlines some modest constraints on thought, which ties it to normative pressure which the world exerts through experience, such that we cannot make sense of the correctness of the thought, its truth, without some connection between thought in general and the tribunal of experience. But there's nothing correlationist about this. And yet, at the same time, it's a significant implication of our finite status as spatio-temporal beings who must orient themselves in the world in specific ways. We can still be realists here, even if our unqualified access to reality has to be achieved in a philosophically significant way. And whilst we can be confident about the prospects for empirical knowledge of the absolute, I don't think we should be as sanguine about the prospects of resurgence in speculative metaphysics, and for similar reasons as Kant gives, or at least my non-correlationist Kant gives. And so a very parting suggestion is that it seems like what's attractive about the move to speculative realism is a a new engagement of continental philosophy with reality, and analysing the world as it is. And as we'll hear from Nick later, more about Latour and Latour's actor network theory. I think that's a good model for doing the sorts of things which speculative materialists and speculative realists kind of want. It engages with lots of the right themes, but I think Latour at the same time very wisely resists any assimilation into the metaphysical tradition, so he kind of rebuffs Graham Harman's attempts to give a metaphysical spin to his ideas. Okay, well, I've kind of run out of time, so I'll leave it there.